Good evening, I'm Neil Pringle. I have much pleasure in welcoming you all here on behalf of the Mechanical Engineering Branch and the System Engineering Society. And as you already know, Lachlan's going to do the presentation tonight and some new opportunities in space, I think it went out as.
Yes, that's the correct title.
So I'll hand it over to Lachlan.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you, it's a delight to be here this evening. Neil didn't mislead you, he gave you the correct title, New Opportunities in Space. I took the liberty of elaborating on that title, which makes it somewhat cryptic, which is Hyperion, Gaia, ABO, New Adventurers in Space. Because I look at any new opportunity as an adventure. It's a chance for we as engineers to undertake a project as an adventure. It's a chance to rejuvenate ourselves, to challenge ourselves, members of the team, to actually strive to do new things, to go forward. And they are new things. All three are space probes or space related. They are all new. And whilst feasibility studies for all the projects, in other words, all the projects have actually started, there's enormous opportunity for other Australians to get involved in this project because they will grow over the next 10 to 15 years. And they'll create opportunities for people to conduct research, for jobs, for teaching, for learning, basically in all fields that are related to our profession in engineering. Well, what are they? Gaia. What's Gaia? Gaia is going to be the start of interstellar travel. And I'll explain why when we get to Gaia a little bit further on. But without Gaia, we will go nowhere. We will go no further than our solar system, other than drifting aimlessly like a castaway on the ocean. We need Gaia. Leads to the next one, Gaia. What's Gaia? Gaia is often a word that's encountered with life, the earth, the mystical Mother Nature. Gaia is an existing project. Its space probe is being built at this moment as I speak. It is going to conduct a census of the galaxy. And why would that be important? What would we really want to know? Well, let's look about what we know at the moment. At the moment, we know about 118,000 stars. And you say, how can that be? We've got Hubble, we've got Parkes, we've got all these radio telescopes, we've all watched Contact, written by Carl Sagan, and yes, they have all these radio telescopes around the Earth looking for stars and counting them and planets. Why do we only know about 118,000? On this planet, we have only accurate information for their position, velocity, their magnitude, their brightness, a little bit about their spectral density, i.e. what type of star they are, and their actual orbit with respect to where Earth is at any one particular time or where our Sun is at any particular time in history. We can calculate that fairly easily. 118,000. Sounds pathetic. And this is called the Hipparchos Catalogue, named after a very pioneering Greek astronomer and scientist who actually created the very first star catalogue on this planet that's in written history. And he charted around 5,000 stars. Sadly, his catalogue was destroyed in successive overthrows and domination of Greece that went along the way with the rise of the Roman Empire. However, it was certainly documented what he achieved in the writings relating to it, and various bits still exist to this day, which is rather good, and that's how we know about him. So this is very depressing, and we only know about stars really up to about a magnitude of 10, which is pretty dull and bright. If you actually go and buy yourself a Meade or a Celestron telescope about 8 inches in diameter, you can see stars down to about 12 magnitude. So basically you're not doing much better than what you can with an amateur telescope to find these things. So why is this important? What will Gaia do? Well, what's Gaia going to do is it's going to go out and find 3 billion stars. It's also going to be equipped with the technology and the equipment to actually go and find planets with certainty. and we'll explain how that's going to happen shortly. It will find stars, magnitude 20. You can't see them from Earth. It's going to actually establish the component motion of space, perspective acceleration, dynamics, find out whether they're binaries, what's the chemistry of these stars, find out whether or not these stars are anything like our Sol, and whether or not the planets are a sensible distance and a sensible mass, like our Earth. Our Earth, we as humans, we benefit from what's called the Goldilocks principle. If we look at Venus, it's too hot, because it's too close to the sun. Look at Mars, it's too cold, it's too far away. And Earth, it's just right, it's Kellogg's, at the risk of an advertisement for a commercial brand. What we want to find is another Goldilocks planet. And then we've also got to find a way of getting there. And that's where the propulsion bit comes in and lots of other factors. But let's find one so we know where we're going to go. And that's where it comes out. Magellan. In the top left is a picture of the map that Magellan set out with when he left Spain. He never lived to come back and get the pat on the back and saying, well done, lad. Thank you for charting the world, discovering the bottom edge of South America, discovered Patagonia, basically ended up charting most of what is now the known world. Didn't find all of it, but he found a heck of a lot, he and his crew. What did he use to get there? He had a map to start with. He had a compass, an hourglass, an accurate timepiece, very important, at least, somewhat crude, a log, quadrant or a pair of dividers, and that was enough for him to go out. He had a crude sextant, and he was able to find his way around this map to get to the points where he said, ah, this bit I know, no one knows about, and this joins on to here. He gained enough knowledge through his exploration. He had a map to get him there. He could avoid many of the pitfalls that had sunk exploring ships and entrepreneurs beforehand, and he could actually find his way there. And that is what Gaia is going to do for us. Gaia is a humble little space probe. Has a solar array, which you can see there in a circular form. It has a telescope built into it, a particular type of scanning telescope that will be specifically geared to actually find stars. It's going to be launched in 2010. That's written in. This project is fully funded. It is going. It is happening. It's being built. It's going to launch on a reliable Soyuz platform, and 5 years at least, we hope. And we wanted to actually go out to one of the Lagrange points, which is just outside our solar system. Well, not quite our solar system, but out to the outer edges of our solar system, and actually sit out there. Nowhere near as far as what Hyperion is going to go, but it'll be out a little way. It'll be communicating with Australian stations in Perth and Madrid, which is not Australian, but Spanish, of course. But they'll be the two ground stations that will communicate with Gaia. It has much more impressive data rate because it's got a much greater power capacity. It'll be able to send back data about 1 megabit per second. But this is not a $400 million job. This is close to the billion, I think, the Europeans have actually spent now. How does it work? All right, it has a small CCD camera built into onto a rigid frame. It is actually just a basically like your small commercial digital camera. It has the same devices built into it. The difference is it actually spins the camera around, and the reason for that is that it does a sweeping arc. And it has a range of filters that it can put in across this CCD camera. So it can look at blue light, it can look at red light, It put quartz filters in. It can look at UV and it can look at infrared. And why would we do that? Well, from our physics that we've done for many years ago, we appreciate that there's slight speed differences in light due to different colours, and that will actually help us in determining the three-dimensional position and location of particular stars. Gaia is in the centre of this image, and you can see it's tilted at a particular angle, approximately 50 degrees to the sun, and it will actually sweep through an arc. Its line of sight, you can see as it sweeps through, it can actually see basically just below our sun. And by it actually rotating at reasonably high speed, which is for a space probe it's a high speed, for us it's very slow, it's only doing 60 arcseconds per second, which is reasonably fast, it's about that speed. It gives us a chance to actually sweep 360 degree image of the star fields and galaxy that it can actually see. It can look out past our solar system looking at stars. Now, one of the problems is that as it actually looks, there's lots of things get in the way. But first of all, let's have a look at about the scanning. If we actually scan for blue light, we'll actually get that type of image of the star field that it actually sees. And when we actually look as a sweep in either red, we'll get a small dislocation. And that dislocation, the greater that is, the further the object is from our Earth. And therefore we can actually work out fairly accurately what that distance is. Now, there is another problem. Light images can play tricks on our eyes, and they can play tricks on Gaia. And Gaia has to be geared up to actually avoid things like the bending of light. Now, if we actually look at a couple of stars, and that's basically due to bending of light, our sun is going to bend light that's coming from stars that are behind it and near it as it passes through the track, and it's introducing an error. Are these different stars or are they the same stars? So what we need is a very clever program, because this is what's actually happening. As we're scanning, see these little stars and them whizzing around in all different directions. They're not actually moving, it's the light moving. And the gravity field of our sun and other suns that are actually in the way of these objects causes a apparent positional shift of those stars. And Gaia, its sweep rate is sufficiently high enough, and it will be out there for sitting there for 5 years in position. That's not counting the time it takes to get there. For the 5 years it's actually on station, it will actually be able to say, hang on a minute, that star shifted in relation to that one. That means that this other star is in the light path and it's causing the light field from this to bend. And therefore I can work out, once again, it helps us work out which star is in front of another. Because how do you know a little tiny star isn't necessarily in front of a big one? It could be behind and vice versa. And we can also estimate the gravity of the stars that are causing this distortion. Now, the star we're watching up the top there, the big white yellowy picture, and there's a small planet orbiting that that star. Now, on Earth we would never see that planet, and what we're looking at is that star is actually wobbling, which you would have read about in a lot of astronomical journals, newspapers, etc., when people say we've discovered a planet because we've seen this sun or this star wobble. Now, we can look at the changes in radial velocity, and that's the curve on the left, that sinusoidal curve, as our planet is orbiting. The other thing is we can also look at changes in the star magnitude, because as the planet goes in front of the star, it will cause a minute drop in intensity or magnitude that we can actually see. And this is highlighted by the step change that we've got there, where planet has gone in front of the star, and hence we've lost the view. So, 1 billion stars in 3D. Fantastic. 3D. We will actually have depth, position, location. So we will actually, for the first time, we'll have a true three-dimensional map coordinate system for the galaxy, but we've got to be able to interpret it. This is fantastic. We're going to actually find something like 10 planets a day by this technique with Gaia. It's out there for 5 years. That's an awful lot. That's 10,000 plus, 10 to 20,000 planets you can find and identify. It'll identify thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of solar systems, and actually be able to give us the information so we, on Earth, can actually classify it. So how are we going to use it? And these are some of the things we'll get from Gaia. Extrasolar planets, binaries, brown dwarfs, we'll find them, we'll find black holes, we'll get information on star formation, we'll see galaxies collide. We'll have all that information in this computer base. You'll be able to zoom in and actually see two galaxies combining, because this guy will gather information outside of our galaxy as well. It'll truly, potentially, in our fingertips from Gaia, we have the opportunity of charting the pathways, not just our galaxy, but to other galaxies as well. And we'll be able to explore physics phenomena, such as black holes, quasars, in better detail, because that information will come back to us. But only if we can crack the code. We've got too much information. We need to find a way of extracting that information and coping with too much information. Overload, computer overload. If we can get it onto a PC, today's type PC, that'd be fantastic. If we could get it onto a Cray computer, that'd be even... That might just... be possible, perhaps, with today's way of thinking, although I doubt it. So we've got to be very innovative in how we deal with today. And this is something engineers can solve, because engineers are methodical. Engineers have a very good systems base. We lay out criteria, we lay out a procedure and a process, we evaluate, we can find out whether or not the road we're heading down is going to work before we get to the end and find another solution. And that's why engineers are needed on this project. The schedule was, I go back. That's the schedule. As you can see, we're talking a launch in 2010. The observations will continue, hopefully, the first 5 years is where, once it gets to its location, will be the massive data, but we're hoping that that will continue on to 2020. Well, it's all very good to have this great bucket of numbers, and where the opportunity is for Australia is to actually... RMIT has been invited, and it's been asked to look for collaborators as well, so we're opening out to the engineering community and saying we want your help to come up with innovative ways of taking all this data, which is absolutely enormous amount of data, and come up with a creative way of representing it. Now, I'm an aeronautical engineer, or aerospace engineer, whatever you want to call it, a bit formal training as an aeronautical engineer. I am not a computer games designer. I'm not a software engineer. But we need people and ideas as to how we can actually deal with all this enormous amount of data. 3 billion stars, hundreds of thousands of planets in the end. We've got to find a way of accessing that data so humans can use it. It's too much information. It's like suddenly someone throwing onto your doorstep a phone book from every city in the world and saying, find Fred Smith for me, or Luigi Ascari, and they don't tell you where, what city they're living in the world. You haven't got hope. We need experts that are good at mathematics, data mining, how to be able to isolate large amounts of that data and deal only with the information that you need to deal with. And the Europeans have found it too hard. The astrophysicists with Gaia have basically said, this is an awfully difficult task. We didn't realise how hard it was. We need new blood. We need different ideas. We need people to look at how to deal with this. And this is a very exciting opportunity here in Australia to get involved with this. People that are interested in virtual reality. Those of you that are Trekkies, and I must confess I'm a Trekkie enthusiast. For those that don't know what a Trekkie is, it's basically a person that watches Star Trek and is enthusiastic about it. This is Star Trek Voyager. We're in the astrometrics lab, and this is a starship that's got lost in the Delta Quadrant of the galaxy, whatever that is, but a long way from here anyway. And the astrometrics lab is their navigation room. It's where they have a three-dimensional image of the quadrant of the galaxy they're working in, and they can zoom in down to the individual planet. They can look at a solar system. They can chart a path from where they are to Earth. They don't have to fly through the black holes because they know where they are. They're not going to fly into a sun. They're not going to fly into a black hole. They're not going to fly into a planet because this database has all that information in it. And that's what we need to give the space probes of the 21st century. If we want to go out there and go 100 light years away, 200 light years away, 1,000 light years away, to a star that has a planetary system that is in the Goldilocks principle just right, that's got that planet that could lead to the future. If we want that probe to get there and carry something living, and we should look laterally, it may not be a human as we know it at the moment. To, at the risk of offending people, it could be some DNA. We could send human DNA to the other side of the galaxy. Why would we do it? We could perpetuate the species by a way that we've never thought of doing before. Let's look laterally. On the other hand, you guys out there that are interested in engines and can come up with a really good propulsion system, you might be able to get a living human there. And that'd be fantastic. And that's what we're going to aim for the future. And all these steps need a starting point, and we need a map, because the map is the future of the human race.